So when we practice the awareness meditation, it will be increased by making images of the Buddha, making offerings to the Buddha, making offerings to the Buddha, making Buddha images. It will be much more increased, our awareness meditation. And this awareness meditation doesn't stop at you just being sharp and quick. It'll be used as a tool for meditation gaining attainments. And when you gain those attainments that are irreversible, you will control your death. You will control your next life. And not only will you control your life and your next life and your death, you will also affect and effect the lives of people around you to transform and effect and affect their lives so they gain control over their future lives and their unhappiness and their suffering. That's what you will effect and affect around you if you have that type of mind. So in every single lifetime, you return again and again and again. And your action is the same from the time you're a small child up to the time you grow up very big. Your actions will reflect your immense compassion for others developed from another time. And each lifetime, it grows and becomes bigger, and it manifests differently. So in Tibet, maybe in a previous life, a manifestation of generosity was giving yaks to people, and then you're reincarnated in let's say, Japan. I don't think an act of generosity is giving a yak to a Japanese guy. Well, over there, maybe we give sushi, you know? Vegetarian sushi. So compassion is there, but the act will be different in each encounter. So the point is, it arises from the mind of awareness. If you have awareness, you will change your habits. If you want to have awareness and you want it to be a Dharma motivated awareness that becomes a tool, a weapon to slice through the actions that make you unhappy with other people and the people around you unhappy, to stop it, then you need the collection of merits. So the collection of merits are varied and very, very incredibly diverse for different diverse minds. So making tankas, offering brocade, offering water, silver, offering black tea, cleaning the area, making images, making stupas, all of that becomes an act of great merit for a specific type of merit, a specific type of purification, where it will bring you back to your mind that when you engage in different types of meditation, such as awareness, results are much quicker. And the results you gain, listen carefully, the results that you gain with your subtle mind, because you have the rakvasheva, the chamakisheva. Rakvasheva means your gross mind. Chamakisheva means your subtle mind. All items gained by your gross mind is lost at death. And a small imprint of it may appear in your future lives. I'll explain. Chamakisheva means subtle mind. All attainments or transformations that arise from your subtle mind is not lost life after life. Example, magical abilities are associated from the rough minds. Clairvoyance of the eye, of the ear, those are associated with the eye and the ear. So therefore, you can use non-Buddhistic practices to gain clairvoyant powers or bomo powers or whatever. But they are lost at the time of death because they are associated with a rough mind. So rough habits, such as maybe in a previous life you love eating pizza. That has something to do with your gross mind that is dissolved at the time of death. Why? The gross mind is something that connects with the subtle mind. The gross mind is something that interacts with the phenomenon around you. The items around you, you interact with your gross mind, which sends a message to your subtle mind. But at the time of death, all the gross mind, which are living in the five senses, dissolve into the subtle mind. And the subtle mind dissolves into a more subtle mind, and that leaves your body, and you leave your body with that mind. So all the things that you put pleasure and effort towards the gross mind is lost at the time of death. If you're very good at weaving and cloth, that is something associated with a gross mind. When you die, it's wasted, it's gone. You can't take it with you. A smell of it might be there in your next life. If you have an onion or garlic in a porcelain cup for a while, you remove it, no matter how much you wash it, there's some smell. So in the future life, maybe you have some indications toward, you know, like weaving, you become a great fashion designer or something. Maybe, but that's not guaranteed. But that itself is not an action that guarantees you freedom. So if you're very good in accounting, if you're good in drawing, spelling, teaching, professor, art, music, if you're attached to dance, sound, if you're attached to books, libraries, all these things, and you develop a skill for yachting, for cruising, and you're very good at that, you waste your time if you focus all your time at that. I'll tell you why. Because those are actions associated with your gross mind. And when you die, the gross mind is dissolved. And the gross mind can only function in relations to a gross physical body. So if you develop qualities that arises from the subtle mind, such as generosity, compassion, ethics, wisdom, patience, awareness, if you develop that in your subtle mind, your gross mind will be automatically affected. Why? The gross mind arises from the subtle mind. So when you die, if you develop compassion, and it's this much to develop, look here please. If it's this much, and you've developed this much, you in your next life will continue from here. Why? This much is with your subtle mind. You're not using your gross mind for meditation. You're not using your gross mind for attainments. Example, when you have dreams, you don't use your eyes, ears, nose, taste to experience. But you feel, you see, you hear, you talk. But you're not using that. What are you using? That is your subtle mind. That proves to you that your mind can exist without this body. And you can feel sensations, fear, happiness, love, whatever, joy. Even someone stabs you, you can feel the pain as if it's real. In your dreams, why? That is your subtle mind in action. The subtle mind arises. The subtle mind arises during the last stage of sleep for a few hours, 1.5, 2 hours, just before dawn. The deepest part of the sleep. Meditators treasure that time because they use that for meditation to contact the subtle mind. Why? Contact what? To make the subtle mind more pronounced, more pronounced, more pronounced, to overcome their gross habits. During orgasm, when we have sexual intercourse, during orgasm, if we have orgasm or we have sexual intercourse only by desire, because people feel that sex is dirty. Sex is not intrinsically dirty. Sex is only dirty when your motivation is dirty. There have been great meditators in the past in Tibet who will have sexual union with someone. After that person will do Dharma practice. It is a way to bring the Dharma according to their level. There are people that they can eat, have dinner with them because that's what they like. Afterwards, they do Dharma practice according to their needs. When you have orgasm, very quick glimpse of your subtle mind will appear, split second. And those who do tantric meditations will able to control their semen. Men and women, let me just say semen for convenience sake, will be able to control their semen when it's released, how long, and they will exercise it during sexual intercourse. Very strong, very powerful. So when they do that type of intercourse, it is not sex. It looks like it. It is practice of using your subtle winds and your drops and your energies in your body to control your body. Oh, those powerful practices. For what? Because when you can control your winds and you can control your sperm, these physical constituents in your body, if you can control, the bliss that you feel is 100 times greater than an orgasm. And you'll feel it consistently, constantly. And you'll always be happy. Your body will be very light. You control it. The type of orgasms that we seek is a lot of work, a lot of effort, a lot of BS, a lot of disappointment, a lot of anger, a lot of talking, a lot of mind games, and then more and more when you get it. It's very different. Very, very different. And at the time of death, your subtle mind arises. These are three times. Your subtle mind arises. And if you do the meditation such as Vajrayogini, example, during this life, you have to collect the merits to the preliminaries and you do Vajrayogini's practice well. Those merits will propel you to be able to attain control over your subtle mind. And then you will be an accomplished siddha. You'll control the weather. Deities will kowtow to you. Life after life, you return to benefit others spontaneously. Your motivations are consistent. Your compassion for others are consistent. And the effect you have in others' lives, the effect and affect will be totally positive, whether they feel it immediately or not. Definitely. And so when you do things, like some people like to do, I don't know, they like to make ceramics or whatever. And they get very good at it. They spend hours, 10, 20 years, become a ceramics master. They get a certificate. When you die, it's gone. The skill is gone. You've wasted so much time developing a skill you can't take with you. But if you develop the qualities that go with your subtle mind, listen carefully. Every time you die, this subtle mind has to take rebirth again. And sometimes this subtle mind will take rebirth in formless realms where you don't have a physical body. It is just mind alone. Yet those qualities still be with you. You will still benefit people in those realms. Still benefit. Beings. So this subtle mind that travels you life after life, when you are incarnated into another body, this subtle mind takes over the body. So normal beings will see their father and mother copulating. They won't see the male and female. They will see either organ that they're attracted to. Either sex of the organ, they'll be attracted. The minute they see that when they're wandering Bardo, they'll be by desire, power, desire, they'll go to the sexual organ of the copulating couple. And they want to touch it and be with it, and they enter. They enter the womb by desire. When they enter the womb by desire, the physical constituents of the father and mother, one drop of blood, red, one drop of white sperm, combines, forms your body, your mind enters into that immediately. The mind has no size or shape. It can fit into something minute or as big as a mountain. It doesn't really matter. And then when that being develops, the gross mind starts to develop over the 9-month gestation period. The gross mind, your eyes develop, your ears develop, your mouth, your body, your tactile feelings, everything develops. Then your gross mind starts to emerge in dependence. In dependence of the gross physical body. Because the gross mind is associated with gross body. So the eye consciousness will immediately go to the eyes. Nose, ear, mouth, etc. Arising from the subtle consciousness. So if your subtle consciousness in your previous life was practicing compassion and love and effort, then in this life, your gross mind will immediately engage in that action again, even as a young child. And therefore, you have tukuls. Highly evolved, reincarnated beings that even at a very young age, they start reciting. They start meditating. They can remember. They recognize Dharma. They like the Lamas. They like the Buddhas. They're naturally attracted. Why? Because the minute their gross mind opens, their gross functions open, it will be a reflection of their subtle mind. So these attainments that you gain from Dharma practice, you never lose. Because they're associated with your subtle mind, and that's what your mind takes rebirth every single lifetime. So it will be more smart for us not to focus on pleasing our mouth, our ear, our nose, our tactile feeling, our comfort. It will be more valuable to please and to develop our subtle mind, which the gross mind arises. Why would you spend time on something you keep for a short time? Every life, it's something different. Then what happens if you're born deaf and dumb? Then all the time you spent in your previous life on sight and sound is wasted. You're born deaf and dumb. But the subtle mind is not wasted because it arises from that. And on top of that, when you develop the subtle mind, it affects your gross activity. When it affects your gross activity, karma is changed. From your gross mind, activities, negative or positive, arise. If your subtle mind is habitually toward negative habits, intoxicants, money, drugs, sex, fun, lying, cheating, tricking people, then your gross mind when you're born will be used to doing that. So if your previous life always irresponsible, this life, the minute you get your eyes, your body, you will come out, you're Mr. Irresponsibility again. And then you create more negative karma. If in your previous life you practice the meditation of awareness and you cut this out and you're aware, every single life when you come back, whether you're a small little kid or you're a grown adult, you will have that kind of awareness. Life after life. And each life, it becomes better and better and better. And your actions will also reflect your subtle mind. Why? What you think deep down inside will be reflected what you on the outside. On the outside, your actions. So it would be more smarter to engage in the practices of the six paramitas, deity yoga, guru devotion, preliminary practices, generosity, creating statues, helping people to get Dharma, being kind, being aware. Why? Those qualities, when you develop, although every lifetime, it will manifest differently. But the motivation is the same. It arises from your subtle mind. So most of us waste our time developing the gross mind. We don't even look at the subtle mind. And therefore, we waste our life. If you're the greatest artist, ballerina, dancer in the world, who cares at the time of death? Who cares? You still go to death with hatred, ignorant, desire, lust. In your next life, you can be a pig. You can be another ballerina. You can be a housewife. You can be a husband. You can be a driver. You can be in the God realms. You can go in, born as a snake. You can be born as a hell realm. It doesn't matter. Why? Because the things you did from your gross mind creates actions for you to be reborn here and there. Therefore, even the gross mind affects where you will be reborn because you don't cut the habit. Therefore, it behooves us, it's very smart for us to do the meditation on awareness, especially in conjunction with the sadhana, example, Guru Yoga Lama Tsongkhapa, and the mantra practices, to recite Miktama, to have the honor to sit at the center twice a week to recite Miktama and to focus. That's what you can do, awareness meditation, and you will see yourself improve. You think it's useless? You're silly. I only like Dharma talks, I don't like chanting. You don't know anything, that's why you say that. You don't know anything. You don't know the benefits. And so therefore, subtle mind is the mind of who we really are. From that mind arises the gross mind, which uses the gross faculties of the body in every life. So if you're born as a dog, your gross faculties will be less. You'll be less aware. You'll do less things. You're able to comprehend less. Why? Because the gross capacity, the gross body, G-R-O-S-S, is much less to accommodate. Therefore, a person can be a dog in their previous life, and this life they can be a professor. The faculties are different. And where you collect your faculty, your faculties, your body, where, is dependent on the karma you create. So if we waste our whole life on eating, sleeping, winning, being right, non-discipline, money, miserliness, if we spend our whole life on that, the actions that we accrue and we get will result in the same results that you've been, exactly how you've acted. And therefore, people who have taken refuge and know the results of cause and effect, you know what they do? They don't focus on all these small things. These small things, they give away, they give this, they help. Very easy. Why? They don't waste time on things that don't bring them benefit, long and short term. But they do things that affect their subtle mind. So therefore, when we do practices such as the water offerings, tanka, setting up altar, the six preliminary practices. When we do these things, we affect the subtle mind. We collect merit. How? We collect merit so that when we do positive spiritual practices, we don't get distracted. It's easy. It's more smooth. It's more quick. Then when we do positive spiritual practices, we affect the subtle mind to make it closer to a Buddha mind. And so when you die, when you take rebirth again, that subtle mind will manifest in a new body. Again, it will manifest in a gross. And then that gross mind will manifest in gross actions. And it doesn't matter whether your actions looks good or bad. Because if your subtle mind has a positive motivation, even your actions look bad to conventional people, it will bring you good merits. And people don't understand that. People have an idea, lamas or rinpoches or whatever should act this way or talk this way or be this way or be that way. That is your convention. That is your mind that is limited, that you limit what a mind that is more developed can and cannot do. So then you have doubt. You cannot gain faith. Why? You cannot gain faith not because your guru is wrong or right, because your view is narrow due to lack of knowledge. So what you can and cannot do is your own convention. Your own convention. Example, in India, if you step on someone's feet, it's very bad. It's an insult. They can really fight you. But in America, you step on people, you're sorry. That's cultural. Similarly, we're not concerned about the gross mind. We're concerned about the subtle mind. All practices of Dharma is to lead us to that mind. And how do we get led to that mind? A, listening and contemplation. B, the collection of vast merits to support the practice. C, effort, effort, effort. A person who's not very good in spiritual practice is usually in worldly life and not very good either. Why? Effort's effort. Effort is effort. The minute a person says, I can't, I can't, I can't, and goes on for years and years and years, it's not that they can't. No compassion, no realization, no understanding, no effort. Very, very clear. So, butter lamps. Butter lamps are exactly the same as I talk about water offerings. Butter lamps in Tibet are very expensive, the butter. It's not easy to get butter. Ordinary people and ordinary monks cannot get any butter at all. It's very, very expensive. In fact, in Tibet, sometimes when there's a patron, they come to like Ganden Monastery in Tibet, and the patrons order butter, and they make big tea, and they offer butter to all the monks. The monks, most of them, will not drink the butter. They'll collect it off the top and keep it in a little cloth and drain it and keep it there and become solid because it's cold there. And they drink the tea, and they collect all that butter. Why? Because these monks don't have any money, and they use that and put it in a butter lamp. And they offer to the Buddhas for the understanding of Buddha's teachings. Instead of gulping it down and eating it and drinking it, they can sacrifice that to gain attainments because they can't afford butter. For us now, we buy candles, we offer, no big deal, no finish, we throw out. No. In Tibet, it was very difficult to get that. They don't have candles that time, only butter. And they make butter lamps. They take a wick, very clean butter, clean cotton, very clean. Can have a stick inside or no stick inside, very. If the stick is very thick, then it will have a lot of smoke. If the stick is very thin, then less smoke. If you know how to twirl it correctly, there's no smoke at all. It's pure cotton, stiff. So you pour the butter inside. That is very precious. And there's a special prayer that is written by Lama Adisha. Because when you offer butter lamps, it is a direct opponent for the darkness that we experience, which is ignorance. When we offer butter lamps to the Buddhas, in this case, in Malaysia, candles or lights, it collects the direct merit of gaining wisdom. Not ordinary wisdom just to be smart in the worldly work, worldly adventures, but to have incredible intelligence and wisdom. A sign of people who make a lot of butter lamp offerings, they're very sharp, they're very quick, they're very smart. Their intelligence surpass normal people, surpass. They create that. Why? A butter lamp is symbolic of dispelling darkness. So when we put a butter lamp in front of Buddha, it's not that he doesn't have a torchlight. He can't see. Or, you know, he lives in India and then there's no electricity, the generator doesn't work. No. We put in front of the Buddha, why? The light that it provides as an offering to Lord Buddha. We make a prayer that our mind will gain wisdom. So when we offer butter lamps, hundreds and hundreds, it is an incredible practice to gain wisdom. So when you offer butter lamps, you know what happens? When you study the Dharma, you understand it quicker and faster. Actually, with butter lamps, you can make any kind of motivation and wishes come true. Any type. Health, you know, wealth, whatever you can. But it itself, by itself, creates wisdom in your mind. Intelligence, brightness, quickness. And that intelligence is not to trick your friend or trick your business partner or steal something from them. That intelligence you use on how to benefit people. How to be of tremendous help to other people. And you'll use intelligence in so many ways that you can develop so many methods. For one simple thing, you can think of this method, that method, this way, this way, this way, very fast and very quick to bring benefit to others. So butter lamp offerings are incredible for developing wisdom, to developing intelligence, to developing the ability to penetrate through samsara's tricks, understand the Dharma that is its opponent, and to gain its results. And so the butter lamps can be of the three types of materials that we talked about earlier also. The best is, of course, silver and gold butter lamps. As many, don't be cheap. Don't be cheapskate. Offer. We have great cars, great watches, great clothes, great lingerie. La Senza's doing a lot of business. Great jewelry, great food. But our butter lamps, we offer a cheap little tiny candle from IKEA, tea light. Please give me enlightenment. Sounds a little contradictory. We should get beautiful butter lamps. You don't have to fill it with butter, because in Malaysia, fill it with butter, it's going to smell, it's hot. And here, butter is anywhere, like 7-Eleven buy butter. You don't have to save it from your tea. So you offer beautiful butter lamps. I'm sorry, candles. put water inside so it's safe, so you don't burn up your whole altar. And then you put candles and you offer it. When you go off, put it off. Don't say, well, Buddha's to protect. If Buddha protect, you don't have accident, you don't die, nothing happened. Of course, Buddha protect, you don't have the karma to receive the protection yet. Don't be ridiculous. And put it beautifully and offer. Butter lamps. And the butter lamps, good quality silver, made beautifully, made very well. And clean it. When you do silverware cleaning for Dharma, oh, it's incredible. If you have the opportunity to clean Dharma ware, you know, silver bowls and silver butter lamps, it's an honor. Why? It'll be used to offer to the Buddhas. You should grab at the opportunity and run there to clean it. You know, slap your friend and grab the silver cleaner and the wipe and say, beat it. I want to be enlightened. Doesn't that great? Not, oh, well, my dog's trainer's mother's sister's brother died, so I can't make it today to clean. Ridiculous. Cover for laziness. So what happens is your whole offering is an art to increase your attainment. It is an art of creating awareness and the placement and the cleanliness and your awareness and pouring. Even the amount of water you pour into each one and the spacing you put in between and the correctness and the straightness reflects all your awareness. You look at how people make offerings on their altar, you pretty much know their mind. Sloppy, some is more, some is less, drip here and there, dirty, messy, not clean, unmaintained, you know their mind already. Very clearly. Very, very clearly. People who have dirty, nasty, horrible, dusty altars, their mind is pretty much similar. Pretty much similar. So if your altar is nasty and dirty and smelly and you know, there's not Buddhas, there's Buddha cockroaches appearing. And the offering's not being eaten by Buddhas, being eaten by Buddha cockroaches. Something's wrong. And if you say you don't have time for an altar, please. People can look at you, well, you know, they'll look at you and what you do and they'll figure out you must put time into something to get that. No, horrible, nasty altars are a reflection of one's mind. Altars should be very clean, you should be very particular, and you should be very excited to make offerings. Excited. In fact, in the monasteries, the monks jump at opportunities to go and make offerings in front of the altars. Why? A lot of monks are very poor. They can't even afford brass. When I first entered Ganden, I had plastic cups, aluminum cups, and I used it for years. I cleaned it well for years. And aluminum, horrible, because the water in India is hard, so it sticks, and it's a lot of white residue you got to scrape with forks. So it would send me hours cleaning those little aluminum bowls. And it took me 5-6 years of making offerings where I can buy my first silver one, but I offered to my guru. And now I use nothing but silver. And I don't have to clean it. I'm not showing off. It does increase. It does get better. And if people offer you money, death money, prayer money, you should put it towards silver items like that to offer on the altar for them. And if people make offerings to you, to make offerings for them is an honor. You collect merit for them, yourself, and double because you're doing for them also. And to offer silver butter lamps and silver items, you know, sirkin, black tea, water bowls, all that, to a temple, to a center, a mandala, it's even greater. Don't wait to be recognized. Don't wait for them to put your little sign there and your name and your smiling face. I offer that. No, don't wait for that. To offer those items in the center and to be used perpetually. Incredible. Incredible. That's why we make many offerings to Ganden Sera Drepung. Why? They will exist on and on. So the offerings we made 200-400 years ago in our previous incarnation, Ganden, it's still there now. Hypothetically, it's still there. How wonderful. So when we make silver butter lamp offerings, it creates wisdom, opens the mind. It makes the mind pliable, and it makes you understand phenomenon more easier. I'm not trying to use big words here. Phenomenon means the way really things exist. And then when you offer water bowls, they represent offering your attachment of your body, speech, and mind, and the 5 sensory attachments. So what you're doing is you're offering your attachment to the Buddha in order to dispel it. When you give something away, you don't have it anymore. When you do that perpetually, it's a subtle imprint on your subtle mind to be rid of that. And you collect the merit directly when you do practice to counter those in your subtle mind. So when you make offerings of the 8 bowls, when you make offerings of the 8 bowls, listen carefully. It is a direct opponent for you to be successful in your meditations, to curb your 5 sensory, your 5 senses, your desires, your speech, the way you act is a direct cause. Why? You are collecting merit for it to become better. Why? That's what they represent. And then if you do just the water, that's fine. You can do this actual sensory offering. Two water, flour, incense, light, perfume, food, and music. What is that? That is a peaceful offering to the deity, direct sensory offerings. Whether you're offering water on all eight bowls or the sensory offerings, it is exactly the same meaning. That's what this holding says, exactly the same. Why? One is just water, but it's representative of the sensory offerings. If you can go one step more, you offer the actual sensory offerings. So when you offer the sensory offerings, the first water is for drinking, nourishment, cutting your attachment towards food, to live for food, to be excited by food, to think about food, to waste your time on food. And from food, you develop all types of diseases and problems and difficulties and unhappiness. Why? Why unhappiness from food? If you weigh 300,000 kgs, and you go on the single seam, good luck. You're going to come home single too. Food is a lot of problems for a lot of us. A lot. And attachment. Second one is washing the feet of the Buddha. Why? Buddha was running around in the mud again. No la. Buddha's feet doesn't even touch the ground. To offer water to wash Buddha's feet is humility. To show superiority. And to generate a mind that is in awe of an enlightened mind. So when you wash Lord Buddha's feet, it is extreme humility, offering your mind. Humbleness. Any master must be humble. Any Dharma practitioner must be humble. Real Dharma practitioners are humble. They don't talk about dreams, their powers, or magic. They won't reveal. They're very humble. Not they're trying to be. It arises naturally. The next one is offering flowers. Flower is for the vision. We want to see beautiful people, beautiful women, beautiful men, beautiful clothes, beautiful houses, beautiful rivers, beautiful cars. We want everything beautiful. Not beautiful, we're not happy. Not beautiful, we make noise. We want everything beautiful, beautiful. We think we get everything beautiful, we're going to be wonderful and happy. No. In fact, beauty brings us even more unhappiness. So offering the flower, which is supposed to be very beautiful, is a direct opponent of the attachment of sight. Then the next one is incense, smells. Exactly what I explained, except related to smell. The next one is light, a direct opponent to the darkness of the mind. The next one is scent, beautiful scent, exactly the same. Then the next one is food. The next one is sound. All the sensory, what we are attached to. When we offer these nicely, beautifully in clean vessels, carefully, well arranged, with concentration, with focus, it is a very powerful method for cutting away our attachments and a direct opponent for lack of awareness and to be accomplished in our meditation practice. When I was in India, before I was sent out to the land of the barbarians, oops, I used to do 500 water offerings a day, every day. I would do that and clean it. I leave it there for, and then after I do it, I clean it, and then I do it again, and I do it again, because I was doing a water offering retreat with aluminum bowls, but I visualized them as gold. Now I do a lot of offerings. If I hear anybody's doing offerings, I sponsor immediately. Always. Why? I want attainments. I want to cut off my attachments. I want to get out of here. I don't want to be stuck in this situation, next life, and I've come across the methods, why not? So making offerings, and then if you can offer it in silver and gold items, on top of that, not only will you have food, resources, and what you need, you'll also be incredibly wealthy. And if you're not born into wealth, you'll be able to obtain wealth to fulfill your purposes. Most lamas are born poverty-stricken, nothing. But they end up in great wealth and they use it to benefit others. Why? From making offerings. And most lamas, they will not be affected by wealth at all. They will never, their mind will never change, their attitude never change from wealth. And you can never influence them with wealth. Why? The whole purpose of getting wealth is not for ego and pride and personal gain. It is to benefit others. And in fact, real lamas, the minute they get something, an offering, money or whatever, they immediately think, what can they get or what can they do? What can they help other people? It's not that they plan it. It naturally arises. Naturally. Immediately, that's their first thought. I'm sure this fella here, what's your name? Mr. Kent, Kent Cigarettes. I'm sure Mr. Kent, you know, we give him 100, We give him $100,000. Immediately, he'll be in Tahiti with a grass skirt and a kalula. Immediately. Me, not Tahiti. I don't like sand and beach. I buy a nice house in Japan. One in Tokyo, one in Kamakura, and I take a limo back and forth. I go to Ginza and go shopping. And I go to Kamakura and meditate, you know, because, well, I want to be a Buddha. I ain't going to take no bullet train. That's crap. I'm in a limo. So when I get $100,000, I say, Japan. Oh, God, that's too close to the truth. But never mind. Okay. When I get $100,000 in Japan, this guy, Tahiti, Smuchi, she buys, opens up, and runs a restaurant. It's an all 24-hour eatery buffet. She will be the buffet attendant. Anybody else does it, she slaps you and she bites you. David Lai, every electronics available, it will be owned by him immediately. And of course, the LV bag, he has an LV hang up. Why? I don't know. Why, Ming? Couldn't you see if the next Elton John opened up, there's glasses upon glasses upon glasses. You try new glasses every day. Andy, he'll buy people to listen to him. Listen to me. You work every day 9 to 5. You got 1 hour lunch break. You got to listen to me. You buy some, you know. So you got 10 people following around here. Listen to him, what he says. Wonderful, isn't it? Fat monk, when he gets 100,000, you know what he'll do? He'll get himself a new guru who likes him. Who'll be nice to him. Who will tell him that he's not lazy or irresponsible. He's not fat and oily and smelly. He's fabulous. Chia, you know what he'll do? When Chia gets $100,000, well, there's two things. He's a little torn. One is to run around with a translator, or the other is to go to Bangkok and... I don't know how to say it. Go to Bangkok and explore himself. Kandarohi, she'll open up a sari shop immediately. Kandarohi, open up a sari shop over there with big saris. Can you see it? Paul, if he gets 100,000, you know what he'll do? You're hiring ninjas to get me. See, he's smiling. Look, look. Very happy. Very, very happy. He hired ninjas to get me. I know it. Get a ninja and get me immediately. Paris, what do you think? If she gets 100, what do you think she'll do? I know what, but I can't say. It's kind of evil. You're like, oh, well, what else is new? Evil. Let's see, what would Paris do? What do you think Paris would do? She get 100K, huh? What do you think? I know what she'll say. She write your own book. See you later. Mwah! I got money now. Rude. Write your own autobiography. That's right. Kunga, if he gets 100,000, open up a Tibetan brothel. Invite Tibetan women here to, you know, show them special Tibetan healing massage. A brothel. That's right. Everybody got their own agendas, but if we get 100,000, if the mind arises, what can I do to benefit others? What charity, whatever, immediately is a clear sign of your mind. That comes in the subtle mind of many lifetimes of practice. It comes from effort. So, butter lamps, water offerings, precious materials used. Why are precious materials actually on their own intrinsically? They're not precious, not precious. We put value on them. From that, it arises miserliness. From that arises greed and attachment. So when we offer gold and silver in our own little mental projections, we believe it's valued more, so we pay more for it. So what we pay more, we're able to sacrifice more. We cut off attachments. Actually, intrinsically to a, actually on its ultimate nature to a Buddha, whether you offer wood or ceramics or pure gold bowls, it doesn't make a difference from their side. But from your side, it makes a difference. Why? It's a reflection of your attachments. It's a reflection of how strong your attachments are and how you want to counter them on a daily basis. All right? Then, the art of black tea. Why is it an art? It's an art because this is going to be really good for some of you who have obstacles and problems. I offer black tea. What you looking at me for, JP? JP's like... And the art of black tea is everybody's going to stand up and stretch their legs and take a 5-minute break. Because I got excited.
Okay.
What we were talking about earlier is the six preliminaries prior to meditative practices or meditation practices, all right? And I didn't finish that. The first one is cleaning the place of practice and setting up the altar. The second one is arranging an attractive display of offerings. Three is sitting correctly in a meditational posture and then taking refuge in developing the Bodhi mind. Number four is generating the visualization of the field of merit. Number five is offering the seven limb devotion together with symbolic offerings of the universe or mandala. Number six is offering prayers and supplications to the gurus in the line of transmission. And after you've done that, the six practices, preliminary practices, then you may engage in your meditations. Then you'll have more success and fruit in your meditations after you've done that daily. Much more. And His Holiness says, the offerings themselves, and the images themselves, at best should arrive from money or resources that are faultless. Example, if you're selling drugs or killing animals and you're using that to make offerings, it's not a very proper offering. It's not a faultless offering. How can an offering be an offering when it arises from things that hurt others, that do not benefit others? It cannot be. And to say that I wish to do this type of action, this type of livelihood in order to generate income to do offerings and support the Sangha is actually not real. Is not true. Negative things cannot arise positive things from negative things. Impossible. And then His Holiness says here, not making offerings is a sign of a lack of spiritual conviction. And a lack of spiritual conviction is a sign of weakness in Dharma practice. Some people say that they do not like to rely upon the practices of setting up elaborate offerings and statues to the three jewels and all that, and they prefer to rely on exclusively the fruits of meditation or meditation. His Holiness says this is a mistake for both teacher and the student alike. Tsongkhapa's extensive Lamrim states that one does not like to rely on the practice of making offerings when engaged in a quest for enlightenment is a sign of limited understanding of the nature of the enlightenment path. The daily practice of setting up offerings, Lama Tsongkhapa, is a solid way of generating positive spiritual energy and dispelling obstacles. The daily practice of setting up offerings is a solid way of generating positive spiritual energy and dispelling obstacles. It prepares the way for successful meditation, as with other supportive practices. This is a supportive practice. It is not meant to be a substitute for meditation, but rather as a supplement to meditation. So some people say, I don't like to make offerings and set up beautiful altars and I don't want to spend money because I'd rather just meditate. That's real Dharma. That's wrong, Lama Tsongkhapa says. That's wrong. Why? In order to be successful in your meditations, you need a generation of merit. Without the generation of merit, simply to meditate, very difficult to get results. Very, very difficult. And long, 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 long time. And on top of that, not making offerings is a sign of lack of spiritual conviction. Lack of spiritual conviction means you really do not believe, you're really not sure, or you're not really committed. You're just wishy-washy. Wishy-washy. Why? Why would you let one day pass and not collecting merits and dispelling obstacles and purifying your karma that can better yourselves to be of more service to others? Even to people just around you that you love. If you can't think of all sentient beings, you certainly be more loving and caring to people around you. Why wouldn't you want to do that? Why wouldn't you want to make offerings dedicated to your mother and father? Why wouldn't you want to make offerings dedicated to people who have been kind to you? Why not? Lack of spiritual conviction. Then, it is a solid way of generating positive spiritual energy and dispelling obstacles. And it is a supportive practice. Some people say, I do meditate, I don't like my offerings. And some people say, well, my offerings are my spiritual practice, I don't have to do spiritual practice. But here it says clearly, His Holiness, that making offerings is a supportive practice toward the actual practice, which is meditation. So they go hand in hand. So making offerings are a supplement to to the actual practice, which is meditation. Actual practice. That's very important to know. Then, again he says here, a variation on the water offerings is put out two water bowls for body and speech. Two water bowls for body and speech. Water to wash the feet and to rinse the mouth. And a scented oil for the mind. And then for the five articles symbolizing the objects of the five senses, the water bowls are substituted with things related to the individual senses, such as flowers for the object of touch. And earlier I said sight is wrong. It's touch. Flowers for the object of touch, His Holiness said. Incense for the object of smell. A butter lamp for the object of sight. Food for the object of taste. And conch shells or musical instruments for the object of sound. In fact, these are so important that I've asked Juan many times to go in Thailand to reproduce these, to make these beautiful and crystal-like and nice so that we can use it here for offerings. And she's working on that in our outlets to have that available for everybody. Let me repeat again. A variation of the water offerings is put out two water bowls for body and speech. Water to wash the feet and rinse the mouth, these two. And the scented oil for the mind. And then for the five articles symbolizing the object of the five senses, the water bowls are substituted with things related to the individual senses, such as flowers for the object of touch, incense for the object of smell, butter lamp for the object of sight, food for the object of taste, and a conch shell for the object of sound. And then His Holiness says here very specifically for people, and this is very important. We may be afraid of making offerings or spending money on making offerings or spending our resources, but that is wrong fear. Those who completely have conviction in the law of cause and effect and what Lord Buddha says, how can making offerings to the three jewels, the Guru, the Buddha, the Dharma, the Sangha temples, whatever, how can that be a cause for you to become poverty stricken? So those who are afraid to make offerings that they are afraid they're going to be poor or they use up their resources, they should not be. Why? Generating merit can only create more wealth, not poverty. So those people who say, oh, I can't do this, I can't do that, I don't want to spend for this, I don't want to spend for that, it's not that they don't want to spend. Out of ignorance, they're afraid that if they spend this for the Dharma, whatever, that they're going to be poor or they're not going to have enough to cover or they won't last. Wrong view. It says here, the practice of making daily offerings generates the merit that causes material prosperity to increase. This does not mean that one should engage in the practice in order to become wealthy and the end in itself. One should have the Mahayana aspiration of wanting to improve one's merit in order to be of greater benefit to the world. The main emphasis should be on the spirit of altruism when making offerings. But if we are poor and can only afford very small offerings, we should do so daily. Then soon we'll be in a position to increase the size of the quality of the offerings. So what is this? When you engage in the practice of water offerings continuously and with confidence, with altruistic mind, automatically you will gain wealth. People who are afraid to use up their wealth to make offerings to the Dharma, when they're afraid, it is not their bad, it is out of lack of knowledge and ignorance. In fact, when we make offerings, we should not be afraid. We should do it very confidently. Why? Don't be selective in what you believe in what the Buddha says. And it says here by His Holiness, this is illustrated by the biography of Lama Drukang Rinpoche Gelug Gyaltso. In the beginning of his life, he was so poor that all he owned was a wooden tea bowl. From this, he would eat and drink whatever simple foods he had and got. Then at the beginning of his meditation sessions, he would wash his bowl out and fill it with water 8 times, each time placing it on the altar for a few moments. So what happens? He was so poor, this Geshe. This monk, so poor, he only had one wooden bowl. He would use that to eat his food, drink his tea, wash it, fill it up once, put it on the altar with water, and then remove that after a few minutes, again and again, 8 times to represent the 8 sensory offerings. Because he was so poor, that's all he had. And on top of that, and that's along with the studies and meditation, because it was so important. And then on top of that, he also had a piece of slate that he would use as a base for a mandala offering, used symbolic of the universe. After some time, his merits increased and his karmic obstacles were weakened. After some time, his merits increased and his karmic obstacles were weakened. He no longer needed to use his teacup for offering bowls and instead had bowls of engraved silver. The slate mandala base was replaced by an iron one and then by silver and then later by silver. The grain that he had been using for the mandala offering was replaced by precious and semi-precious gems. The Lama himself once said, "In the beginning of my practice, I was dressed in rags. Often I did not have even plain barley flour to eat. But I made my water offerings every single day. Then someone gave me a Nepalese coin as a gift, which I used in order to buy butter immediately. Then someone gave me butter. Then I went to the temple of my monastery, which had a special butter lamp that when filled would burn for 2 whole days. It was my plan to use half the butter to fill this butter lamp and to keep the other half for myself to use. However, when I melted the half portion of the butter and poured it into the lamp in the monastery, the butter lamp, the vessel became only half filled. Therefore, I melted the rest and poured in as well, so I had no butter for myself. I made this offering at the time of the festival of the celebration of Tsongkhapa's birth, enlightenment, and passing away." That is around December. "And after that offering, my fortunes completely changed. Now I am able to make hundreds of excellent offerings daily. Hundreds. And my resources never seem to become depleted," Drukhang Rinpoche says. "We can find countless anecdotes illustrating how the practice of making offerings daily acts as a condition heralding material success." So what it says is this, this Lama was so poor, he would use his bowl for everything. That poor, and I've seen monks like that, it is true. It's not just a story, I've seen it myself. Monks who can't afford 75 rupees, $7.50 ringgit, to even go to the hospital to take care of their swollen glands. They'll lay there for days, cannot eat and swallow. I've seen it. Very poor. I've seen monks wash their clothes and wait for it to dry and then wear it. They'll stay there the whole Sunday waiting for the clothes to dry on one set of robes, nothing else. In a bare room, in their underwear, waiting. I've seen it with my own eyes. How poor they are. Yet they never give up study and practice. This particular Lama had one bowl. He used it 8 times to make offerings and used it as whatever for eating. He had no choice. Usually we can't mix up ours with the Buddha's. And then he got one Nepalese coin. He could have gotten something wonderful for himself. And he plans to do half-half. Instead, he melted the butter and offered it to the butter lamp in the monastery during Lama Tsongkhapa's day. Very auspicious day. And when he saw it couldn't fill it, he filled it all the way up. He gave his final attachment. That's very, very powerful. His final attachment, which weakened his karmic obstacles. And from that, his fortunes went up. People come and make offerings to him, receive teachings. He got sponsors and patrons. He transformed all his bowls to silver, his mandala base to silver, precious gems. And on top of that, his wealth never depletes. And he makes offerings all the time. This is not something I've heard once or twice. These are things I will tell you I've witnessed many, many, many times. People who are scared of making offerings, scared of contributing to Dharma, and they fear that by doing that they will be without wealth. They do not fear. That is not by a Tibetan standard. That is not by a protector standard. That is not by some Lama saying that. That is Buddha's own promise. Believe in the Buddha. And when you give it from your heart, without any motive, without any recognition. Make their offering completely pure. Faultless. Faultless. Faultless meaning by motivation. And then, when you make offerings continuously, definitely your endeavors will become easier and better. Definitely, if you're worried about finances, you'll get it. It is a direct method for collecting finances. That's why those who are very smart, and those who, smart meaning what? Wisdom smart. They will engage in water offering practice as much as they can. Whatever they get, they'll offer the best that they can, as much as they can, and it'll be focused on that. Why? It will collect great amounts of wealth. So for religious institutions like Dharma institutions, and you want it to be beneficial and reach out to many, the institution itself must make many offerings. Many. Why? You'll create the causes for you to do that. So there's no need to fear, no need to worry. And if you want to be stingy and miserly, please do, but do it in a good way. What way is that? Make more offerings so that you can be always wealthy, always rich, always powerful in the future, always. if you're going to be rich in the future, you have to create the causes to be rich. The causes to be rich is not to keep wealth. The causes is generosity. So when you give wealth away, you create getting wealth. If you keep wealth and it's out of attachment, it is creating poverty. You may be rich now and have money now. It's not guaranteed for your whole life. It's not guaranteed for the future if you don't create the causes. If you don't. I myself believe that very, very much. Very, very much. I believe in offerings because for most of my life, I've been extremely poverty stricken. From my teenage years to my years in the monastery. What this Lama says is very touching because I experienced the same thing. I was starving in Ganden Monastery in the late 80s, early 90s, starving. I ate only barley flour. That's it. I couldn't get sponsorship. I begged a few people for sponsorship, $50 a month to support me. I couldn't even get that. It was very difficult. I starved for years. When I first came to Malaysia in 92, you'll see pictures in the book, I was a walking skinny stick. Everybody, Wai Ming was there, he knows. Walking skinny stick. My arms looked like tube lights. And why? I didn't get food. But I didn't mind, I didn't complain because I didn't go to Ganden to eat. I was very happy to be there and starving. Why? I'm in the middle of Ganden, Dharma, Lamas, rituals, pujas, tsok, meditation, teachings, Dalai Lama, Sorimchi. Oh my God. I mean, you know, go give that up and go to America so I can go to, you know, a steakhouse. What for? Oh, I starved for years in Ganden. Starved. And I even wrote my step-parents and they wrote me back letter. You made your bed. You slept in it. Too bad. Don't beg from us or our relatives. That's what they used to tell me. And I met a few sponsors, small ones here and there, and they would always ask, how much do you have? And I say, why? They say, well, we'll top off what you don't have. And I say, oh, forget it. You want to offer? Offer. Don't ask me how much I have or don't have. It was very, very difficult that time. Very difficult paying bills. I only had, you know, a few hundred rupees to survive all the time. And at one time when I was coming down from teachings from North India, South, I had my bag completely taken. I think I had 600 rupees. It was a disaster for me. Because that would last me about 1 month to 2 months, depends. It was horrible in one way. But in another way, I learned many things and I appreciate things and I don't take things for granted. And I noticed that it doesn't affect me. But continuously, I did offerings in the monastery. Continuously. All the time. Aluminum bowls, whatever. I would do it every day. Sometimes two or three times a day. And then when I got sponsors and I got patrons and help later on, then I donated out to the monastery. Tankas, silver bowls for the monastery, monks, tuberculosis. You know, I was supporting 250 monks. Every month I would supply their food and their robes, whatever they need. I was doing that. I still am. And I love it. And I was building up the hospitals and I did more and more, putting water for the villages, more and more and more and more. And so wealth will increase. Whether you make it, you inherit it, or someone gives to you, doesn't matter. If you have the karma to get it, you will get it. And how to make the karma? Generosity. You must oppose miserliness. If you're attached to your wealth or your material possession, whether you have $1,000 or $1 billion, it doesn't matter. Your attachment is the same. And you must trust the three jewels and practice generosity. And I'm not talking about giving to our Dharma center in any way, in any shape, any form. Generosity. The more one does not practice, one creates the fear of losing wealth. If you're afraid to lose it, do things to avoid that. This is what the Buddha says, what the Dalai Lama says, and what Lama Tsongkhapa says. I don't know who else to throw inside the soup to make you be convinced. So if you're going to kowtow to Tsongkhapa and Buddha, then you have to believe what they say. Why kowtow? Why? Why pick things you like and things you don't like? You say, oh, I don't believe. Engage in offerings. Offer the best silver bowls. Offer the best offerings. Offer the best butter lamps. Offer continuously, daily. Pure, clean water. Clean it well. Maintain it. And do it with a good motivation. It definitely will create wealth and success. Definitely. Multitudes. Multitudes. Not, it shouldn't be done for that motive, but that will be the side benefit. Then it says here, okay. Then, Tibetans have a special system which is different than many, many other Buddhist countries, except China, Japan, which is Dharma protectors. Dharma protectors are two types, as I mentioned a few days ago. Two types. Listen very carefully. One is super mundane or enlightened. One is mundane or unenlightened. Within the super mundane protectors, there are fully enlightened beings. There's no doubt they're the level of a Buddha. Whatever you do towards them is exactly what you do towards the Buddha, because their level of attainment is the same, although they manifest different forms. Within the mundane Dharma protectors, you have two classes of Dharma protectors. Within the mundane, you have those who are actually mundane and worldly and appear like that, or those who are enlightened appearing as mundane deities. And the reason for that is sometimes the king dresses in beggar's clothes and goes among the marketplace to listen to the people, their opinions, and what's going on in order to rule the kingdom even better. Similarly, highly evolved beings can manifest in worldly protector forms so that they're closer to us, nearer, and when we invoke upon them to ask them to do something special for us, it will take less meditation, less merit, less affinity, and less connection to get a faster, quicker result because they're closer to us. Example, very simple. If we have a friend in the United States and we're in Malaysia, and we have a friend in Singapore, and we're very sick, and those friends are very close to us, and they're very, very good to us, and they're equal in their love for us and us for them. We're very close friends. We've known their whole life. When we become sick and we send out telegrams or emails to them to come and help, who can get here faster? Of course, the one in Singapore. Simply because of distance. Similarly, enlightened beings, they manifest as worldly beings, worldly Dharma protectors, who by all appearances are worldly in appearance. Their accoutrements, their regalia, their clothes, their signs of their worldliness, symbolic. But their mind is of enlightened nature, completely enlightened. And the reason for that is from an emanation to another emanation to a third emanation, which is in complete mundane worldly form, very close to us. Very close. Example, if we were to hope to receive teachings from Heruka himself, it's kind of hard for most of us. But if we receive it from Heruka's emanation body, which is Trijang Rinpoche, much easier. So if we worship Trijang Rinpoche and make offerings to Trijang Rinpoche and have his statue or keep it on our center, if we keep it on our center and it's the guru of our guru, it's very auspicious because it makes the center grow even more. Because the blessing of the guru's guru in the lineage, very important, just as mentions here. So what happens is, when we make offerings to Trijang Rinpoche, is equal to making offerings to Heruka. And that's our teacher. So we can listen to the teachings from Trijang Rinpoche. We can hear it. We can make offerings to him. We can massage his body. We can make offerings of food. We can help him to spread the Dharma. He gives us an opportunity in the emanation body to collect merits. Because with Heruka, how? We can't even see him yet. Similarly, in the case of Dharma protectors, they will arise in worldly forms. When they first arise in worldly forms, when they first arise, usually, I've seen it a few times, and I've heard it in history from my different teachers, the Kagyupa teachers, the Gelugpa teachers, all. When they first arise, there's a lot of controversy, there's a lot of doubt, and there's a lot of mystery, and people don't understand their nature. Why? They say it's a worldly protector. But as time goes on, 1 year, 2 years, 10 years, 20 years, 100, 200, their renown and their precedence will grow bigger and bigger and bigger. Why? Even the great deity Yamantaka, when he first was introduced to Tibet, he was considered a demon. It took hundreds of years until Lama Tsongkhapa came to firmly establish that he is a fully enlightened Yidam and very beneficial. Why? Why so much obstacles in the beginning? It doesn't come from them. It comes from us receiving their benefits. So as time goes on, their power and their manifestation and their blessings and their ability to manifest to help us will open more and more and more according to our karma. So, Dharma protectors, when they arise in worldly forms, usually, it takes time for them to become established. Why? From the point of the viewer, the subject, not the object. So it takes time, and as our mental obscurations go, as times become conducive for them to manifest, means a Dharma protector will manifest specifically at a time, at a time and a place that their particular emanation and skill will be useful. Some Dharma protectors, they dissolve back. They're not used anymore. They re-emanate in another form that's more appropriate. more appropriate. If we were to, now it's 2000, in 21st century, if we're going to wear things from the 60s or 50s or 40s up and down the street, we're going to get stares, unless you're Joanne Dan, of course. But if you're anybody else, you wear things from the 50s and 40s, you're going to take a look, what's that? So you reinvent yourself. You go in, you become Madonna, you wear something else, you come out, you're you again, you know, like Madonna. Similarly, Dharma protectors that were, you know, if you had Dharma protector help you take care of crops and locusts and, you know, and all these people, and you don't need that anymore. You don't have crops. Now you need Dharma protectors that protect you perhaps from, you know, car accidents. So what happens is the Dharma protectors are like Madonna, reinvent themselves and reappear in different forms. When they first appear, many beings have doubt. Many beings don't understand due to a lack of merit. When Buddha appeared, there were many people who didn't believe he's Buddha. They challenged him, tried to kill him, sent nasty elephants on him. They tried to, you know, assassinate him. They said nasty things. Women were sent to say he slept with them and they're pregnant. He says, okay, no problem. I'll take care of the kid. Oh, you read his biography. There are plenty of nasty people all the time trying to get rid of Buddha. All the time. So what? If he doesn't have the karma to be harmed, he cannot be harmed. So Dharma protectors are the same as any other enlightened being when they appear to benefit others. When they first appear, there will be some roughage, some difficulties, some talk from the high, from the low. But don't ever doubt. All high beings, no matter what they say, white or black, positive or negative, will serve to be conducive to make each other grow in helping others. So sometimes we need to say something very negative to make something grow. Sometimes we need to say something positive to make something grow. Sometimes we need to say something negative to make it grow. And then when it grows that big, we tell its nature. So different practices. Why? In samsara, you have negative and positive minds. Some people are attracted more by negative. Why was Madonna, I mean, no disrespect to her, but her voice is considered not great. I think it's great, but it's not considered great. What's great is her controversies. Her sex books, you know, her shows where she actually wears Gautier bras, you know what they look like, two cones, and she's always doing something nasty with herself on stage, you know, or she's always wearing nasty clothes, but, you know, actually the lack of clothes, that was her problem. And she built her notoriety up. So now nobody thinks about what she did before. Everybody's like, Madonna, Madonna. I even go to China and go, Madonna. They everybody know, Coca-Cola, Madonna, Michael Jackson. That's what they tell me all the time. So like that, in this world, notoriety works if you use it for the right reason. So some deities will arise in the midst and out of notoriety. And slowly their natures will be revealed. And their compassionate nature will arise. Definitely. So when we follow along like that, like that, like that, we're not sure. We collect a lot of negative karma. So worldly protectors may appear as worldly beings, but their mind is not. Example, the Dalai Lama is a worldly being, his mind is not. Trijang Rinpoche is a worldly being, his mind is not. His Holiness Karmapa is a worldly emanation, but his mind is not. He is in worldly form. So Trijang Rinpoche coughs and sneezes, get a cold, you say, but you're a Buddha, how can you get cold? His mind's the Buddha, but his body is still subject to the conditions of this world because the body is of this world. What do you expect? You know, high lamas never get sick, don't get hungry, no need to poop, no need to put a toilet in their house. They dissolve into emptiness. No la. They're borrowing this body. They're using this body to benefit others, so this body is conditioned to this world, but their mind is not. And they can emanate in other worlds where their body is very light and subtle, different. So that's ridiculous. In fact, some high lamas use their bodies to absorb other people's sufferings and difficulties. They suffer more for other people. They get more sick. They have more difficulty and problem to suffer for other people quietly in their own little way. They use their bodies to absorb. Some can. Some can. Me, I got a headache. I'm not going to absorb nobody's no problems. I take a Panadol, two or three, quick, get rid of it. So what happens is this. When we have a Dharma protector, the purpose of a Dharma protector is to protect you to stay in the Dharma. The ultimate nature of a Dharma protector is keep you on the path to stray away from virtue. So if you are going to make a lot of money and you're going to use that to gamble and use it on all types of nasty things and then degenerate yourself and lose your wealth and become a nasty person, your Dharma protector, if you're lucky to have one, will stop you from getting wealth. That's why some Chinese, they pray to Dharma protectors, I never get money wealth. They never give me one. It's real. Of course it's real. In fact, you don't know what the Dharma protector he or she is doing for you. If you pray to a worldly Dharma protector, their wisdom is limited. They give you immediate benefit. That's why when we go to certain temples everywhere in the world with worldly gods, we make offerings and stuff, we get wealth, we get 4D all the time, very fast. Like the four-faced Buddha, it's not a Buddha, four-faced Brahma of Thailand. I know people who make offerings and they get 4D very fast. Not one I know personally. But you exact a payment from them. They take something from your karma to give you. Later you have to pay back. If you don't, they get you. So their effect is very quick, but so is the result. Whereas when you make offerings to the enlightened beings, the effect doesn't seem quick to you, but the effect is long term. Why? It doesn't take away from something. And it gives you ultimate wealth on a long term basis. Any Dharma center who has the merits to have a Dharma center assigned by their guru, assigned by their monastery, they have the merits. They should have beautiful images of the Dharma protector. They should build beautiful cabinets and beautiful silks and offer beautiful items on it. And they should offer banners. And if possible, a personal chapel. And get a large statue of the Dharma protector, fill up with precious metals and precious mantras. And give and let people feel the awe of the Dharma protector. Why? Tibetan Buddhism is very unique in that it comes from a poverty-stricken country with no country anymore. Yet it's the fastest growing faith around the world, the quickest among all. And wherever it goes, the lamas show up in rags with, you know, cloth bags, and they end up very big and different in the end. Why is that? It is a specialty of the Dharma protectors. The Dharma protector practice in the Tibetan tradition is very quick in making things happen. Very quick. You notice, you think about it. It's not like those great Dharma masters from Taiwan. They're very great. And they come to the different countries with wealth already. Why? They have sponsors and patrons in their own countries. Because they have their own countries. They're rich. No problem. Like those Hong Kong ones. No, you know, many. But Tibetans, they don't have that. They don't have their own country. They don't have anything. And their country is quite barren. So what happens is these Tibetan lamas, for the sake of making the Dharma grow, the great Guru Rinpoche from India brought over many Dharma protective practices. Along with the Disha, many great Lama Lundin Shetha, they brought over. Why? Because our land is barren, our land is poor, it's poverty stricken, and it's very difficult to get materials to make the Dharma grow. So when we have Dharma protector practices, it is to help alleviate the immediate physical obstacles for the Dharma to grow. And if it can do that there, it can do that here. So Dharma protectors can be used in our factories in a correct way, it can be used in our personal lives, it can be used in our centers, it can be used for our practice, it can be used for protection. It can be used to remove obstacles, it can be used to ward off black magic, it can be used to make our journey and what we need to do clearer and softer and faster. Softer means less obstacles. So when we do a Dharma protector practice, advisable is enlightened protectors, advisable. Advisable. So what happens is when we do a Dharma protector practice, a real Dharma protector practice requires you to have bodhicitta. So you need to have refuge, have a lama, you have a meditational deity such as Hiruka, Vajugini, you have accomplished the retreat, then you take an initiation of the Dharma protector and you keep that and you do a retreat and you do the offerings every single day. The effects are very powerful. Very, very powerful. So in these times now, where people show up in Dharma centers, unlike Tibet or before in China or whatever, where they come solely seeking the Dharma, they come to your center looking for, you know, cures for their body, you know, 4Ds, you know, relationships. They don't come for the Dharma. It's very rare. Where they come because they hear that the teacher's got a big mouth and he's interesting. So they come and listen and watch. Many, many reasons. Everything but gaining bodhicitta and enlightenment. So when they come, what happens? They have all these problems. So for the Malaysians, I go backwards. It's okay, no problem. Instead of giving the lama first, hey, I'm your guru. I say, no, forget it. Let's just be friends. And for most of you, I want to remain friends. Thank you very much. And then second is idams. Third is Dharma protector. So I skip the idams, skip the lama, skip the commitment, skip all that, give them a protector immediately. Why? When they get their results, they come back and say, how come that worked on? And then you teach them the Dharma. So you hook them in. So in Malaysia, I hook them in with Dharma protectors. Any problems? I point them to a Dharma protector. Whatever they like. I do a divination. It's different for different people. So once you do a Dharma protector practice, minimum, you should do Lama Tsongkhapa's Guru Yoga, or at least Mikchama 21 times. Why? To arrest the power and the blessings of your Lama. Then afterwards, if you have a Yidam, for example, if it's Tara, you can do Tara's prayer and mantra. And after that, you invoke the prayers of your Dharma protector. in a clear, bright area, you set up separate offerings to your Dharma protector, and you may offer him, her, anything that you offer to the three jewels as you like. Except their offerings will be more of a wrathful nature. Why? Wrath and ferociousness is associated with quickness of activity. If someone's really slow, some silly little waiter is getting on your nerves, you tell them, oh, please help me, get me a glass of water. 15 minutes later, you're sitting there, you know, choking because you don't have water and you're dying. You're spitting because your mouth is so dry. Thank you. And then you scream, grab my water. They run here. So wrath can be used for speed and quickness. So therefore, the Dharma protectors, their job is to protect us from inner failings of Dharma practice, protect us from going off the wrong path. Outwardly, they can be invoked. Listen carefully. Outwardly, the Dharma protectors can be invoked to help you in job, harmony, negative energies, black magic. They can help you in even increasing your life or protecting your life from dangers. Travel. General, for things to come more quickly and faster, they can help you. Definitely they can help you. And how they help you is the level of your motivation. So when your motivation is better, if you do, you know, if you do prayers to Dharma Protector, ask them to kill your enemy, it's never going to happen. Never. And Dharma Protectors are wonderful because they don't create problems for you. They don't create deities. Unlike worldly gods and worldly deities, if you don't go and pay your respects or say thank you or worship them, they get you. Dharma Protectors don't. They don't get you at all. They're Buddhas. So what happens is, when you do, after that you do, example, your Yidam. If you don't have a Yidam, you get one from your Lama. You do your Yidam practice. After that, you do your Dharma Protector practice. So what, when you do your Dharma Protector practice, you offer the sensory offerings. If you have a representation of your Dharma Protector, that would be wonderful. A statue would be most preferable. Tanka, if you're a cheapskate, a picture. Or if you're really surviving, you know, you make 100 ringgit a month, okay, picture la. Beautiful, and set up beautifully, nicely. Why? As you develop this relationship with your Dharma Protector, I promise you, you will see the effects of this being in your life more and more and more. Things that should not happen, happens. You're like, oh my God, that's so helpful. Miraculous things. And sometimes Dharma Protector will manifest to us in our dreams, in our daily lives, or give us indications. If we're supposed to do something, and we're supposed to go someplace, we're going to have an accident, we lose our keys for no reason. Things like that will happen all the time. Miraculous things. Even sometimes, you know, stopping rain for you if you need to do something outside. Incredible. Their abilities. It's been known. It's been recorded. It's a given. From the highest Lama to the Dalai Lama, to the lowest street urchin like me, Lamas, me, all have Dharma protectors. Assigned to us by our monasteries, our previous lives, or our gurus, or affinity. So what happens when we have that? We do our Dharma protector practice well. And our Dharma protector practice can only benefit, cannot harm. Why? Dharma protectors can never, ever harm. That's why they call Dharma protectors. And if we believe them to be a fully enlightened being, as our gurus say, then even if they're evil spirits, the evil spirit in that Dharma protector cannot manifest. The blessed being must manifest. Example, if someone gives you a Dharma protector that, you know, I don't know, like this one, and it's a demon, you know, and you didn't know they give it to you, but practicing it for 2-3 years. Let me tell you something. Because you believe in your Lama, and your Lama says, hey, this Dharma protector is emanation of Kuan Yin, you know, and you believe it's Kuan Yin, and you pray to it as Kuan Yin, and you believe your Lama, then that demon cannot manifest, cannot do anything. Kuan Yin will manifest through that as Dharma protector for you. Why? By the power of the blessings of the three jewels. Do you think a Dharma protector who's evil, or that's not a Dharma protector, do you think an evil spirit can pose as a Dharma protector? Do you think an evil spirit can override a Lama? Do you think an evil spirit can hurt a monk, or hurt a guru, or hurt the Dalai Lama? Ridiculous. If they can hurt the Dalai Lama, or hurt your guru, or hurt a monk, where's the practice of refuge? Where's protection? So then, they're the highest? An evil spirit can hurt your guru? No. People like the Dalai Lama, people like Trigyen Rinpoche, people like Kajit Pabong Rinpoche, no one can hurt them. You can do all the magic you want. You can do all the hate spells you want. You can do anything you want. There is no way you can hurt them. Let me tell you why. They don't have the causes to be hurt. Their karma obstacles are purified. So when people say they can be hurt, and people believe that, stupid. It's simply jealousy. simply politics or some ulterior motive. Impossible. Impossible. No possible at all. I refuse to believe. If you believe that, then it's ridiculous already. So that's why I have read before that even if your lama gives you a rock and he says that's Manjushri's emanation, it fell from Manjushri, and you believe and you pray to it as if it's Manjushri, all of Manjushri's blessings will come through the rock. Not because of the rock, because Manjushri's power and you connecting. So if you do Manjushri's mantra, it will connect through that. And Manjushri will override the rock or the spirit or demon. So if this is a demon or a spirit or evil, whatever, and you believe it to be Kuan Yin, immediately Kuan Yin will be there. Why? It says in the sutras, Buddha said clearly, if you visualize me here, if you think I'm here, I'm there instantly. He's omniscient. No one can override him. No one. Impossible. Impossible. Then, if the Dharma protector comes from a correct lineage, comes from a correct lama, comes from a correct monastery, correct practice, there's no doubt. No matter what people say or what people think, whatever, it doesn't really matter. Why? Everybody has differing opinions. But our commitment must be very strong. So when we do Dharma protector practice over a period of time, we will see many, many types of benefits. It doesn't matter which Dharma protector. It doesn't matter. So within that, you have the liturgy, the invocation. Then you have the offering part. Then you can recite their holy mantras. And then you have the praise. You can offer the tormas. And then, finally, the black tea. The black tea is an offering to Dharma protector to invoke him or her to do your work quickly and fast. It's like offering a drink quickly. So when you do a Yidam practice, those who do Dharma protector practice who have a higher tantric initiation, it's very beneficial. Why? Because if you visualize yourself as Vajragini or Hiruka or whatnot, when you visualize that as whatnot, you're not offering a cup of black tea, you purify it with the respective mantras and visualization, and it becomes the nature of bliss and emptiness or nectar. So when you offer to your Dharma protector, you're not offering a cheap cup of tea. You're offering the nature of emptiness and wisdom to accomplish your work. So they have a liturgy. First, always, the black tea is offered to the gurus and the lamas of the lineage. The next one will be the yidams and the dakas and dakinis, enlightened beings. And the one after that will be the Dharma protector. After that will be the Dharma protector's entourage. After that will be a general offering for all the entourage, and last but not least will be an offering to the emanations of the Dharma protectors that we have not seen, we don't know about, but they're there, offering to all of them. So each time you recite the liturgy, then you pour the tea a little bit. At the liturgy, you'll see clearly, I offer this tea for style of great bliss. I offer this drink for style of great bliss, you offer it. And when you offer this, you're actually prodding the Dharma protector to do something. So what happens is, in very difficult situations, and very scary and dangerous situations, a dangerous situation, really, really dangerous, the actual liturgy of the actual Dharma protector, the actual one, you will do more. You can do 21 times. You can do 108 times. You can do 200 times. You can do more. And the more you do, you're prodding the Dharma protector, please help, please help, please help, please help. If you have a difficult assignment, you need to accomplish something, you need to write a letter to get into college or whatever, you will take that letter usually and put it under the statue of your Dharma protector. And then you do a black tea. That's why it's very important for centers to have a large statue of their Dharma protector. You should provide that service that brings relief to your members. And when you put a large statue of a Dharma protector in your center, what you're actually generating the merits for your Dharma protector to do even more. Even more. Much, much more. That's why in all Tibetan monasteries, including His Holiness, there's always a section, a chapel for the Dharma protectors. Even His Holiness, there's a special chapel down there. And the monks are put there to do tea every day. It's that important. That important. And centers that are very successful in the world, every lineage, they have a Dharma protector practice as part of their practice every single day. They will do it as part of their prayers. Why? By invoking a Dharma protector. Oh, yes. So if you have a statue Dharma protector, it's very powerful, very, very powerful. And it grows with time. The energy and the blessings grow. Never be cheapskate, especially for your Dharma center. Never. Don't care they like you, don't like you. Put it there. It benefits people. What's your motive? To be praised or to benefit people? And then you can put things under Dharma protector to protect. Even strings. If you don't have lamas, your gurus, or anything around, no one qualify. You can even take red strings, tie it correctly, and you put that in a precious bowl, you know, like a silver bowl or whatever, you know, clean one, and you put it under Dharma protector's kasiwara statue, and you do black tea, and you ask Dharma protector, please bless these strings. Maybe someone's going on a journey, difficult situation, and you give it to them. It will be blessed. You don't have to be a lama. It's not your power. It's Dharma protector. It's Dharma protector. A lama will bless the strings by his mantra and his meditation. Dharma project directly blesses. It's okay. Very, very powerful, very, very good. And then the money you put towards the Dharma protector and the images or the offerings, don't ever think it's lost. It will be multiplied and multiplied and multiplied. Believe in the karma, cause and effect. And so when you do this black tea, when you actually get the liturgy of that particular Dharma protector, if it's a dangerous situation, you do 21 or 108 or more. If it's a normal situation, 3 to 7, it is fine. And so you pour it on the top, and this vessel, you don't think it's just that, you think it's big and beautiful and vast. And you pour it onto the top. As it pours down and overflows, it's a sign of action. I'm sorry, it's symbolic of action taking place, overflowing of your wishes, overflowing of your needs, overflowing of your wants. But if you're not really interested in this type, it's okay also. Here you have beautiful ceramic bowls, you have beautiful glassware. You can put anything you want. It doesn't have to be double-tiered like that, like they did in Tibet. Don't think the Dharma protectors are particular. No, you didn't give me a double tier like I get in Tibet. I'm not going to help you. I don't think so. But it's beautiful because these are made especially for that purpose. It's very, very beautiful. All of us, we should offer a big one for the Dharma Center. Oh, it's very precious. And we should get these small ones to offer for our own Dharma protectors at home. Our particular ones. Make a connection. Why? How much meditation practice do you actually do to generate merits? This is an opportunity. And you know, once you offer this up, that's it. No. Every day when you use it, you generate the merits. The same. Every day. So if you use this, you know, 10 years down the line, you're still using it. Every day you generate merits. Think about that. Think about that. That's really worthwhile, your investment. And then you do the mantras, you do the meditations, you do the commitments. If you're very fortunate and your lama confers you on the initiation of the Dharma protector, then you're bound until bodhicitta. Until you achieve bodhicitta, your Dharma protector will follow you and be with you every single lifetime. Every single lifetime. And it's a very powerful practice that originated from India, that was brought over by the masters of Tibet, because our country is really, you know, it was very difficult to get Dharma across. And so these Dharma protector practices, many types, many kinds, male and female, all lineages, Nyingma, Sakya, Kagyu, Gelug, all is wonderful. No, choose. You choose what your lama has given you or what your lineage belongs to, and confidently do it. You will get the result. And especially for your Dharma practices, to avert, divert, nullify, purify, stop your obstacles. Rely on Dharma protector practice. Every single sadhana, heruka, is four-faced, mahakala. Yamantaka is Kalarupa, the protector. Vajrayogini is the skeleton couple. No, it's the skeleton couple. Every tantra, you do the sadhana from the beginning is to the guru, in the middle is to the yidam and meditations on the generation and completion stages. And in the end, you know what? There's always a section to do black tea and tarma offerings to the Dharma protector of that tantra. Why? Because when we do Dharma practice, we purify negative karma at an increased rate. Many obstacles arise. So at the end of any sadhana, you do a Dharma protector practice, depending on what lineage it is. And then you conclude it with auspicious words. It is every single tantra, every single practice. Guhya Samaja is six-armed Mahakala. Every single. In Kala Chakra also has a Dharma protector that looks just like him. Same colors. All. Why? Obstacles are huge. And if we do these practices every single day, it doesn't have to be long, but it has to be committed. And we trust and we do, you will see things fly. You will see things change. You will see things move. But if you want to do a Dharma protector practice daily, wonderful. The most important commitment is this. Humility. 8 verses of thought transformation. Compassion, forgiveness. If you have those, the Dharma protector helps you. Those are the ingredients of Dharma protector practice. The ingredients. Then when you're doing the Dharma protector practice, or you're doing the Yidam practices, if you're doing any of the rituals and any of the practices, you have specific items to help you, to remind you of your commitments. The commitment of the belt, commitment of Vajra. And also when you lift up the Vajra, I can't talk too much because of the nature of Tantra. Most of you don't have initiation. When you lift up the Vajra, there's a way, according to Gyudu and Gyume. Gyume is like this. Gyudu is like this. We belong to Gyudu. Lower Tantric house. And the way you lift it is symbolic of the practice you're engaged in. So when you lift up your Vajra, You may think the reason you're doing this practice, the Vajra reminds you of method, male, compassion. So when you lift this up, immediately you think energizing the male energy within you, invoking the male energy within you, balancing the male energy within you. And out of great compassion, I will do this practice. And then when you invoke the deities, when you hold this out, it's very powerful because it represents, by the power of your compassion, come forth. When you lift up the bell, I'm giving you very simple, I'm not going to go extensive. When you lift up the bell, it represents wisdom, female energy. Balancing the female energy within ourselves. Female is not gender. It is the nature of the energies, yin and yang. So when you lift up the bell, you remember female energy, which is totally necessary. And wisdom. Wisdom is necessary conjoined with bodhicitta or compassion to become a fully enlightened being. So when you do the mudras and you do the rituals with your vajra and bell, what happens is not just mudras and beautiful hand gestures. It's a full meditation. You should have the liturgy memorized. You have the visualization memorized. So when you're actually doing this, for example, I'll give you a very simple one. When you're actually doing this, you visualize yourself as a deity. Yamataka, Hiruka, doesn't matter. From your heart, from the seat of your heart, emanates many, many dakinis. Beautiful ladies, slender, slender in build, and extremely vibrant. And they're skilled in the 64 arts of love. And they hold beautiful items, and they float. And they come out from the nature of emptiness. And they hold the particular offerings. So you do the offerings by doing this. You emanate the deities out. You turn the lotus. And then the first offering is offering the beautiful water to all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and deities. And you visualize at the same time millions and millions of dakinis offering water to the three jewels. Pure, clean water and fabulous vessels floating in the sky. Then you dissolve the dakinis back. Then the next one, again, you emanate the dakinis out from your enlightened mind. And you offer beautiful, fabulous water, clean and pure, from vast vessels to clean the Buddha's feet, to wash the Buddha's feet, to show humility. This is the mudra of cleaning in the higher tantras. Then again, the billions of dakinis are dissolved back into you. Then the next one is the dakinis of offering flowers. So what happens is this, same visualization, and you concentrate. And you scatter the flowers onto the Buddhas. And what happens is mudra, is mantra, is meditation. So when you're doing this, a tantric master must be in full meditation. It's very powerful. You don't just look here, look at me. You don't do things like that. I mean, there are people like that. People are looking at, they're like, I have a bell and you don't. Yeah, they ring their bell all the way to hell. See you later. No. And it should be done very focused, very articulated, and practiced. Why? Even the mudra represents the dance and the sway of the dakinis. So the beautiful ladies, very beautiful ladies, slim and slender, of different colors representing the five elements and the five senses, and their hair is swaying, and they're naked on top, and they have beautiful tight sashes on the bottom, and they're floating, and they're smiling. And they actually look like ladies, but they're wisdom. And they go out, and they're dancing. They don't just, sit in front of the guru and throw the food at them. Here, eat la. And then they jump, they go in front, and they dance, and they swirl. Their whole bodies swirl, and they dance, and they move. And this represents the mudra of them dancing. Beautiful delights. So some of us are attached to dancing. The more we're attached to it, the more we become attached to samsara. If we like dancing, we transfer that into divine dancing to offer to the Buddhas. By offering dance to the Buddhas, you cut your attachment to dance. Doesn't mean you're not allowed to have it. It means that negative karma that arises from attachment to dance is eliminated. So this mudra represents the dance of dakinis. So actually when you're doing this, you visualize the millions of dakinis swaying and moving, and their hair floating, and their beautiful bodies slender, and they're very, very elegant, and they're beyond any beauty you can see in this world, ethereal, floating, with a beautiful offering, singing and dancing and moving in front of Lord Shakyamuni, for example, or Tara. And they're making offerings like that on your behalf. And then the Buddhas dissolve, the blessings of the Buddhas come back with these dakinis and enter back into your heart and dissolve into your heart. So your mind is focused. And if you have awareness meditation, you can focus on this. It's very powerful because it's meditation and movement. So it's like this. Om.
Om aguru benza dara sumati kiti sabari wara agum paji jai soha Om aguru benza dara sumati kiti sabari wara paji paji jai soha. What is that? This is the offering to Lama Tsongkhapa. Lama Tsongkhapa's personal offering is so beautiful. Then you can do dara, you can do your dharma protectors. Oma aire taire sabari wara agum. Short form. Pa dien pu be du be aloke gende devende shabda patita honso. If it's a higher chanter, you have a dhammaru. If it's a kriya or charya, only vajra and bell. Dara sabari wara shabda patita honso. These are offerings of sight and sound and music and mantras to the deities in order to develop awareness, develop detachment from the five senses that we are so attached to, in the forms that we perceive, that we're so attached to. It is designed to cut that off. So instead of always looking for beautiful things and wanting beautiful things and desiring after beautiful things, we offer these very beautiful things as a method. We use them in order to cut our attachment to them. So in the lower schools of Buddhism, I'm sorry, in southern schools of Buddhism, they totally detach you. You don't visualize beautiful ladies, you don't visualize beautiful men, you don't visualize, you know, drinks and all these things. You don't visualize it all. You cut yourself away. But in the northern schools of Buddhism, you visualize it and you enjoy it, but you offer it to the Buddhas. So it's two methods. One is quicker because restriction cold turkey is very difficult. Enjoying it for a while but offering up, okay, you know, you slowly create detachment. It's like going to a clinic where they give you a little bit every day to detoxify. So like that, you make these beautiful offerings and these beautiful mantras. And they represent the offerings you're making. So when you see Tibetan lamas or masters, they're making offerings. Their mind is not blank. Their visualization is strong. And their liturgy is very strong. And their focus and concentration is very strong. They have very powerful meditation abilities. And they can make these offerings on your behalf. So when you use ritual objects, it is to remind you of your commitment. You wish to develop bodhicitta. You wish to develop compassion. Wisdom. You wish to engage in this practice out of compassion. And through wisdom, you're going to sever all unhappiness through wisdom. Then at the same time, this reminds you to invoke the power of the Buddhas to come forth. And on top of that, you offer beautiful sight and sound to the Buddhas. I use this one here because it's not too loud for the neighbors. And your vajras and bells should be kept very well because we're going to do Tara prayers in the future. I ask everybody to get a pair. You should be kept very well. And your vajra, Swamiji said, is you should mark one side. It should not be this way or this way. You should mark one side up to be always top and bottom. This is top, this is bottom. Not leave it unmarked. And on your vajras, you have a face. The face should face you. And there's a way of holding it. There's a way of using it. We won't go into that too much today. But having a vajra bell on your altar, you can even offer that up to the three jewels. Is a sign, please give me the tantric practices in the future that are very quick and fast. Very, very powerful. Very, very powerful. So when you use this, it's an offering, total offering to yourself, to deities. And when you do black tea, it's wonderful. When you do black tea, you can make the offerings, you do the chants. It's a very staccato. You do the chants, you do the staccato, and you offer it. Or if you don't want to do staccato, when you actually do the offering, you ring the bell. Then you do the liturgy, then you offer, you ring the bell. Bring attention. Dharma protectors, hear me. Listen to me. Please hear me out of your great compassion. Please come forth. I make these offerings to you, and I ask you to grant me the necessities or whatever you're praying for to come forth. Please, I invoke upon you. Make offerings to them.